You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 261 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you as usual in different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. And you said, as usual, in different places. This is completely off the cuff here. But for my birthday in 2 weeks, do you know what we should do?
Is it record a podcast in person?
Podcast in person for the first time in history.
I will be fully vaccinated by then, so that'll be the day. So we can do it.
8-Ball and MJG. Let's go!
Well, that'll be exciting to actually be able to share a beer in person. But for now, as usual, we'll be drinking the same beer separately. And this week's beer is That's Baseball Baby Pale Ale from our friends at Cloudburst Brewing.
Hello.
Game on. When making a sessionable pale ale, you got to go at least 3 for 10 with the hops. We got all the numbers, so we went heavy on the Azaka and then used Citra and Eldorado too, with notes of pineapple, grapefruit, and Rainier cherries and a lower APV. Have a few, just not 64, and rope a line drive out of nowhere. What do now? So this beer, you will note, a couple weeks ago when we had Cloudburst, it was in reference to Saturday Night Live and Kyle Mooney. This time, it's an homage to It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia's season 10 opener, The Gang Beats Boggs,
where they
try to beat Wade Boggs' legendary record of 70 beers on a Yankees trip from New York to Seattle, which is a story that is full of Seattle ties and a Pelton Cast tie. At the time of the story, Jeff Nelson was a Yankee teammate of Wade Boggs, not at the time he told it. First told it on KJR while filling in for Fifth Taco Time co-host Mitch Levy.
That's the podcast time?
That is, yes. It's very indirect.
That is a stretch.
So that's not the first stretch on this podcast, and it won't be the last.
Wow.
The exact number of beers Wade Boggs drank is in dispute. Nelson originally said that Boggs would easily drink 50 to 60 from the team meeting at Yankee Stadium to begin the trip to arriving in Seattle and unpacking at the Kingdom. So then when this happened on KJR, the next segment, they called up fellow former Mariner Paul Sorrento, who played with Boggs in Tampa Bay, and he came on and estimated over 70 beers Boggs on an East Coast to West Coast road trip. Somehow 64 got out there as the number. I couldn't find the background of why that particular number. Except, I don't know, you know, the NCAA tournament back in the day, that sort of thing. Charlie Day, who was the person who went 3 for 10, was trying to go 3 for 10, I guess, but roped the line drive out of nowhere in this episode, said on Conan that during the taping of this, Boggs told him 107 beers, and Boggs told TMZ later over 100. So we will not be drinking over 100 beers on this podcast.
Did they specify? I have so many questions still. We've talked about this before. Are they Miller Lights? Because that barely counts.
It was Lights for sure. I can't remember which kind of beer.
Just the sheer volume of liquid, the ounces that it would take to drink that many beers.
I mean, I thought about this and it's like, that would be miserable because you would just be peeing constantly.
It is. I mean, the most impressive part, it's not Wade Boggs' liver, it's his bladder that is most impressive, right? This is, I don't know. This is one of the greatest feats in mankind history.
I mean, look, the idea that you could average a triple-double for a season, again, after Oscar Robertson, once seemed unthinkable. Now Russell Westbrook has made that ordinary. Wade Boggs, that's the unreachable, unbreakable record in sports.
It really is true. As I don't remember the episode exactly, but I think as the It's Always Sunny episode proved to us.
Correct. I don't know if they quite got there.
This was the whole gang trying to beat Boggs also.
Well, you know, I did read the Wikipedia description and Mac had to serve as commissioner. So he was not trying to beat Boggs. And much of the crew was also distracted by other things. I believe in Sonny Lore, Dennis fathered a child during this particular episode, during this trip. So, yeah. All right, let's get to our toasts, starting with congratulations to the famous Cousin Katie for this earning.
A toast?
It is, yes. For earning her third consecutive Felton Cast MVP win with 36%.
For me, this is a let's pour one out to my candidacy for Felton Cast MVP. This is not a toast for Katie. Okay, finish what you're going to say.
Well, you will notice that the famous Cousin Katie is not joining us this week. She's on a family vacation. We will plan.
Not invited.
We will plan to have her on the air next week to celebrate her victory and discuss chicken with us.
You say that averaging a triple-double has become an everyday feat for Russell Westbrook. I'm doing more than that on every single one of these podcasts. I'm drinking 107 beers on an East to West Coast road trip every single fucking week. Katie comes on 1 to 2 times a year, spills a sandwich all over herself, awkwardly orders, and boom, she's the MVP. Is that all it takes?
Well, if awkward ordering was all it took, then Zach Whitman would be the Felton Cast MVP.
I don't think I recall a single Katie appearance from the entire year.
There definitely were some classic Katie experiences from the past year.
God.
And so Katie received
Jan's epic performance. That was multiple years. That was actually like 2018, just fresh in my mind.
No, I think it was 2019, but it was not within the
past
year. Jan's
star making performance for walking down the Vegas Strip, getting a single chicken strip at Popeyes.
People still talk about it to this day. So Katie had 36% of listeners' votes. Let's remember some years came in second at 25.5%. So we also finished behind in inanimate object and something that we have not specifically done in months.
You know what? In honor of the Felton Cast Hall of Fame, it makes sense that we would finish behind an inanimate object.
You were third with 21% of the vote, despite your desperate pandering for votes.
No pandering. I'm not pandering. I'm putting up numbers. That's like saying that
But you're out there.
LeBron James is pandering, right?
Well, when LeBron James does the whole like, "Oh, I'm always the MVP of the league," that's begging for votes, and that's what you were doing too. And some of us have the self-respect and not to do that.
Thank you, LeBron.
And we finished last at 17%.
Caruso over here.
Good news,
MVP of the league.
Wow. Good news shared by Donald Watts on Twitter that his dad, Slick Watts, Felton Cast Hall of Famer, is headed home to continuous rehab after suffering a stroke last month. So important milestone in that process. And, you know, we continue to wish Slick all the best in his recovery.
Can we get a vote from Mike Sean? I mean, epic performance by him at the Felton Cast live show, right? I mean, what did Katie do?
I don't know. No one nominated Mike Sean. That was an oversight. I agree.
I mean, he would have won too easily. It really wouldn't have been fair.
Next up, a toast to Kent's own Kenny Mayne, who announced Monday that his run at ESPN will be coming to an end after 27 years. Really a legendary, iconic run for Kenny Mayne as part of SportsCenter at ESPN. And also I learned today reading his interview with The Athletic that the show he did, Main Event, starred a young Aubrey Plaza as well.
Really?
A wild fact.
What was the show? It was on ESPN?
Yes, it was a fictionalized version of his own life. And she played an ESPN executive who was
really
part of this show.
Wow.
So.
This is not going to happen on The Ringer, I think. But I'm just gonna throw that out there. But it would be great for like a Ringer style think piece about it, maybe even an oral history about that show. I feel like that one's been lost to the sands of time.
It is ripe. I agree. I may suggest it to someone at The Ringer. All right, UW women's soccer saw its run come to an end in the Sweet 16 with a 1-0 loss to number 2 seed North Carolina, but still a great run in the NCAA tournament. Same for UW men's soccer, which reached the Elite 8 before losing 3-0, also to number 2 seed Pittsburgh.
Wow, why are we not talking about soccer more?
I mean, kind of got lost in the spring season. There was just so much going on in terms of UW sports.
We had to remember an old basketball season. Look, there was a lot going on. There were cookies out there. I just got caught up.
And lastly, congratulations to Breanna Stewart, who announced today that she signed a shoe deal with Puma and will become the first WNBA player since Candace Parker a decade ago with a signature shoe, which is not expected
from Puma,
to drop.
From Puma or anywhere?
From anywhere.
No, are
Puma
you
just got back in the
me?
Basketball shoes game. But yeah, no woman has had her own signature shoe.
Doc, what's the difference between a signature shoe and a shoe? Like what?
Well, like Sue gets her own colorways sometimes, or her own versions of Kyrie's, but they're Kyrie's. That's his signature shoe.
This is fucking horseshit. Oh my God. I'm yes, just finding is. This out.
And now you're outraged.
Every single week I see people on Twitter post about how they didn't get some horseshit shoe from Nike, right? We're all here just slaves to capitalism right now with what they're doing, and they can't give a single WNBA player a shoe for a decade?
Yeah.
This is an outrage. If you were a young women's basketball player, like not being able to buy a shoe from one of your favorite players, this is wild to me.
It's very true.
Whew, okay.
I did not expect you to get so worked up during the tennis.
I'm just, it's all because of Katie. Katie has her signature shoe.
I don't know what the Katie signature shoe would be, but we can brainstorm on that one. Do you want to do Coach's Corner this week?
I don't have a huge Coach's Corner. Again, I was forced to coach.
Obviously.
Mrs. Fantasy Genius and I actually got into a fight about who is going to coach this week.
Oh.
She volunteered to be team parent at the beginning of the season, which apparently means that you also bench coach. And so the game on Saturday came, everybody was there except you were noticeably missing. Everybody in the family was there to cheer on Luca, who is going to be pitching for the first time. And I was like, you have to bench coach. I don't want to do it. I'm done coaching. That's it for me forever.
Famous last words.
So anyway, as I was bench coaching. honestly, not a ton happened. They basically got crushed by this team from Maple Valley. It was actually the team that they played in the first game, who I described as 100% white and 100% unmasked. And the most important note that I made about this team is that they have sponsorships on the back of their jerseys, and they are sponsored by Iron Creek Construction, which really reminded me of your foe in softball, those fuckers at Ballard Sheet Metal.
Like, we knew when we looked at the schedule that Ballard Sheet Metal was going to be the arch rival for Sonic Softball. And lo and behold, there was almost an altercation during that softball game.
That's what I'm saying about Iron Creek Construction. In the first inning of ball, Luca was playing first base. This was before he was pitching. Luca was playing first base. The ball was grounded to him. Maybe somebody flipped it to him. Anyway, he made an out at first, which, look, any out that a defense makes is a real feat.
Agreed.
And then he gave the kid who was running to first the Mutombo, wagged his finger at him. Yes.
Wow.
I'm just telling you right now, he is so self-conscious in every other situation. And like, if you're playing music in the car and driving by, another person will be like, roll up the windows. You will throw a fucking fit if somebody hears the music you're playing. And then gets on the baseball diamond, and he is the most animated person. I'm like, everybody here is watching you do that, dude. This is so much more, like, I don't want to say embarrassing because I thought it was great, but, and the coaches seemed pretty happy with it also. And then he came in and pitched, and in the inning that he pitched, they got 5-run ruled. So,
wow.
It wasn't doing a lot of finger wagging then.
I don't know if he got run ruled a couple of times when we were hitting off him on Sunday.
Oh, man. And we ran those numbers up.
I mean, the important coach's corner note on that one is that at one point he was like,
"That's you saw where he learned."
yes, definitely, we saw where he got
what?
It. Like, Dad, this isn't fun. This is like school, because we were trying to learn how to shit talk. because we were trying to like explain to him how to stride as a pitcher, and it was too much teaching. Apparently, he was no longer having fun.
Look. Honestly, if you're saying, Dad, this isn't fun, this is like school, welcome to baseball, dude.
Well, baseball maybe can
that's
be fun.
Under the MLB logo. MLB logo. It's not like fun. It's like school.
Maybe MLB will be a little bit more fun. We'll talk about that in a bit. But for now, I think it's time to continue our search for Seattle's best fried chicken, which took us to a unique location this week, a convenience store that is highly regarded on every list of Seattle's best fried chicken. It's an unassuming location in the Seattle Central District, located on Jackson Street at the intersection with MLK. And yet the descriptions rave about the fried chicken there. So we had to undoubtedly include this in our search. And I got to say, everybody was right.
I wasn't sure what you were going to say. So you called me and were like, call ahead to make sure that you figure out what types of pieces of chicken there are that are available. And I didn't really, like, I didn't comprehend exactly what you were saying until I got there.
It seems pretty clear to me. I don't know.
I just didn't really understand it or whatever. But I feel like you walk in, you just get it right away, right? Like, this is a fried chicken place. It might be in sort of like a corner store, but really the driving factor here is the fried chicken. And after I went to Yelp and looked it up, I was looking for the address, but I had skimmed some of the reviews and just like, I cannot fucking wait to have this fried chicken. This is some of the fried chicken that I was most excited to eat, maybe aside from the place that we're going to go this week. And then again, like, you told me that you gave no hint of how we're very good at not talking about these things before we talk about them.
Oh, I mean, we are well practiced at that, sir.
And after that, I was like, oh, I think Kevin might not like this fried chicken. And then I ate it.
Well, I mean, first off, at the time we talked about it, I hadn't eaten it. I called you on my drive home. I didn't eat it until I got home.
You didn't eat it on the drive home?
I didn't. And it was still a delightful temperature when it got home. That was a positive.
Yeah, it actually probably was the right temperature. You live a lot closer there than I do.
Yeah, yeah.
But the difference between us is that you didn't almost get into an accident on I-90 eating that chicken driving home.
Please do not get into an accident for the sake of it. You can just eat in the parking lot there. It's perfectly allowed.
Everywhere. Grease Boy. Everywhere all over my Honda Odyssey with my 10 to 15 children in the backseat. They weren't actually with me. But the first thing that struck me was, so I walked in, and they had mostly wings and legs, which is what you had also, right?
That's all they had available when I got there, yeah.
I was like, do you only have wings and legs? And he was like, there's a thigh in there, the person at the counter. And I was like, okay, can you do, because they had seven wings for whatever, like $13, or seven legs for like $13. And I was like, can you do six legs and the wing? And he was like, and the thigh. And I was like, nah, it's a different price. And I was like, can you do five legs in the thigh? It's like, whatever the number was, I was going to trade out the legs for the thigh, wherever that number equaled the right amount. So it was five legs and one thigh for the $13. And I started with a leg. They're so easy to grab. These are giant chicken legs, different than almost, we're talking like fucking Ren Faire, medieval times level chicken legs.
I mean, I wouldn't go quite that far, but yes, it's a full on drumstick, I would say.
You did not need seven of them.
No,
I did not need seven of them.
I went with two legs and a wing.
And I was excited to eat them. And by the first second I crunched into that chicken, it was just like, good God, people. What are we doing here? Why have we not been eating this chicken our entire lives?
I don't know. I mean, I would say that the spicing was really good. The breading was really good. I would say it was a style of fried chicken that is not specifically my favorite style of fried chicken, because I like it probably a little more in the buttermilky range than this. But if this is the style of fried chicken you like, I can see why everyone is so high on this chicken.
I mean, I suppose so. It's like perfect crunch. The flavor was just fried chicken flavor. You know what I mean? It didn't try to do too much. There's sometimes where I'll make stuff and I'm like, you know what? I'm getting too far away from what this chicken tastes like, right? Like, I don't need as much rosemary in my goddamn fried chicken right now. Like, I just want it to taste like fried chicken. And that's what it tasted like. This was traditional fried chicken, but the absolute peak of it. And bit into it. The insides are perfectly greasy and moist, right? Flavorful. Every single bite was phenomenal. And I feel like the proof for me was really in the amount that I ate. I had three of those legs and a thigh. It's actually all the food that I've eaten today. The thigh also was massive. The chicken, you should have had the thigh. Like, it was incredible. It was the best chicken thigh I've ever had in my entire life. Not even close.
Really? Wow.
I'm not going to say that this was the best chicken that I've ever had, fried chicken that I've ever had in my entire life, but the chicken thigh specifically, like eating it, and there was like, it was just perfectly done. Like, one bone left, tons of chicken on it. You know, like a lot of times when you get fried chicken, there's a lot of fluff. Sometimes there's a lot of fried, and there's a lot of like weird pieces and little bones and shit like that, fat and garbage. This was just like chicken, all of it. There was so much meat all over it. I had very high expectations going in, and I was prepared to be disappointed. I was prepared to think it was fine. And this immediately shot to, I don't know if it's number one. It's very close. I think for me, this is the second best fried chicken. You didn't think this?
No, I don't think it was that.
It's because you didn't eat it right away. I'm telling you.
No, I don't think it was that. Again, I'm telling you, there's just a different style of fried chicken that I don't like, that I don't prefer as much, I guess I would say. So
I'm excited to try this and cookies around the same time as each other.
Interesting. So what's your rating here?
I'll give it a 91.
I mean, to me, it was more like really good neighborhood fried chicken. Like, where if we go back to our discussion of neighborhood teriyaki. I mean, again, it's just not quite the style. That says more about me than it says about this fried chicken, without question. But to me, it was more like an 89. So.
Wow. All right. I really ate this friggin' chicken with glee. Like, first bite into it. I seriously was kind of shocked. Number 10 on Yelp, although that's not sorted by rating because there's some Azels above there, which I do not think should be. I mean, this is highly regarded chicken in Seattle. And I think from your description, like, kind of understated, but highly regarded.
Well, I think it's, if people who are in the know love it, but not everyone knows about it, which is why we didn't know about it until we started searching for Seattle's best fried chicken. So
absolutely,
that's the joy of this search, is to discover new things and learn about them. So
it was to me, this was a great experience.
It sounds like you think this belongs in the bracket. So I'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
What did we put in the bracket immediately last week?
Taco.
Oh, we moved the taco straight to the... God, how many are going to be in this bracket?
It's going to be like 64, actually.
Cookies has to be in there.
Yes.
A round of 64. Or can we do eight? Is that too many? Six?
I was planning on us doing eight, but that already is filling up, and we've got some highly regarded competitors to get to.
This is going to be in the top eight.
Okay. You want to introduce?
Well, so far, the one, Taku, Cookies,
D&E.
Well, I just want to go through the ones that I feel like are confidently in.
You don't, I mean, you rated D&E higher Taku, than
cookies,
this, so
D&E,
you
quick back to
clearly think that, yeah. Maono?
Man, Maono's got it. Ah.
Yeah, I mean, that's at least five right there. So.
We'll see.
There's not a lot of spots left.
I would be surprised if this is the one that gets knocked out.
not a lot of spots left, and you want to go to a place we have been eagerly anticipating for a long period of time this weekend.
This week, again, we've been circling it. I have to look at what their deal is right now. It's supposed to be very sunny in Seattle on Sunday for chicken dinner on Sunday. We've been waiting. You said basketball games are happening earlier. It's the last day of the NBA season, right?
It sure is.
Of the NBA regular season. You're going to be celebrating the end of the NBA regular season.
And I can't wait.
We had to do it to him. It's time. It is time to go get Eduardo Jordan and June Baby's fried chicken, generally regarded as the best fried chicken in Seattle. We will see.
Yeah, that's going to be a big one. So we have to talk about one other fried chicken place this week. We teased this on last week's pod. I finally made my triumphant return to Portland last Friday to go to Blazers Lakers, as the Blazers got a key victory that should allow them now most likely to avoid the play-in tournament, to finish sixth ahead of the Lakers. Their magic number is one after they won in Utah earlier Wednesday night. And before making my way over to the Moda Center for the first time this season, I had to stop at Screen Door and try their fried chicken in the context now of the additional fried chicken knowledge and ratings that I've accumulated over the last couple of months here. And so I had never done, we'd done takeout once from Screen Door when we were in Portland and you had the kids and didn't want to take everybody to the restaurant. But now it's obviously almost exclusively takeout. There are a few tables you can sit at and eat at, but primarily takeout. And one thing I did not realize is quite how long the wait was going to be on a Friday night for Screen Door. I placed my order at 5:20 and got the confirmation that it was going to be ready at 6:10. And then due to a miscommunication on my part, not understanding that I had to like tell them I was there, I was waiting for them to call out my name because they were calling out the names of people who had come up and placed orders as opposed to placing orders online. I didn't actually get the chicken until 6:30. Okay. So I was rushing to eat it and get over to the Moda Center for the 7 o'clock start. But the good news is the chicken was, again, still the perfect temperature. It was great. And I housed those two pieces of fried chicken within an entirely unhealthy period of time because I was so hungry and so excited to eat Screen Door for the first time. Instead of going with the chicken and waffles, since I figured that would be difficult to eat in my car, which is where I was eating, I went with the fried chicken dinner, which is still boneless chicken breast. They do that for all of their fried chicken, is one thing I discovered over the past week. And it comes with mashed potatoes and collard greens as sides. The mashed potatoes are kind of like the highest quality possible version of KFC mashed potatoes, is how I would describe them. But with this knowledge, again, with all these chicken places that we've tried in the past couple months here, nothing about my opinion about Screen Door fried chicken has changed. It is still the best fried chicken I have ever had, bar none. And I would rate it on our PeltonCast scale a 98.
Whoa!
Yeah. I mean, I'm leaving room for maybe there's some chicken. I mean, surely there is chicken out there that I haven't had that is better than this. But it is close to my platonic ideal for fried chicken, even though there are no bones in it. And maybe because there are no bones in it.
Okay. Can you tell us why? Give us a little bit more about the Screen Door fried chicken.
Every bite is so flavorful. It's not necessarily super spicy, but, you know, there's a lot of pepper in there that you're getting, surely some cayenne a little bit, and just there's a strong flavor in every bite. The fried part itself, either the fried part itself when it comes off or the chicken itself, are delicious individually. And then because of the fact that it's kind of, these chicken breasts are kind of pounded flat, you know, sort of like a chicken parm, basically, the ratio of the fried to the breading to the chicken itself is ideal, in my opinion. And it's just so perfectly cooked in terms of being moist on the inside, crispy on the outside. Like, I have a hard time seeing how you could improve on it.
Oh, man. All right.
And this is a place you chose not to go when you were in Portland.
I'll be back. I'll be back to Portland.
as we speak, Wednesday was the very first day of the second location for Screen Door in the Pearl District, which opened up. So next time I'm down there, I may try to hit that up instead of the one on the east side, the original location. Should we talk about Seattle sports?
All right.
Let's start with the Seattle Kraken, who have a player, the first player in franchise history, is center Luke Hedman.
He's the Kevin Pritchard of the Kraken.
I was going to make that reference.
God, there we go.
Wow, we are on it today. Kevin Pritchard, famously signed by the Vancouver Grizzlies, is a free agent ahead of the expansion draft, the first player in Vancouver franchise history. I don't think he ever played a game for the Grizzlies.
Huge.
But I definitely remember that NBA hoops card of Kevin Pritchard.
That's the reason that we know this. He'll be the freaking GM when the team comes back to Vancouver. Hashtag bring him back.
It's center Luke Hedman, who is currently playing for the Blainville Boisbrand Armada in the Quebec Major Juniors Hockey League.
There we go. Important to learn that center is apparently also a position in hockey.
Oh, no. Are we at this point? Are we just learning this? Can we? Oh, boy. I don't know who's going to come on to explain hockey to us. Well, Randy, Talking Taco Time co-host Randy, will perhaps be handling that. Hedman, a 21-year-old native of Nova Scotia, an amateur free agent who signed a two-way contract. Hedman was drafted by Carolina in the fourth round of the 2018 draft, 1 year after Kraken GM Ron Francis's departure, but was not offered a contract ultimately by the Hurricanes. And so the real fundamental point is he may never see the ice at Climate Pledge Arena, but this will definitely be the answer to a Peltoncast trivia question someday.
There we go. Wow. Bring Peltoncast trivia back too.
Seriously. Man. Get vaxxed for Peltoncast trivia.
You're talking about doing a live show this fall. Let's worry more about Peltoncast trivia this fall.
More about that? No, we can do both. Save the date though. Tentatively.
What date are we saving?
September 17th. That's what we're tentatively thinking.
Wow.
Throw it out there.
Kind of late for Peltoncast Live.
Well, I'm going to be out of town the first weekend of the Seahawks season, and they're not opening at home. So logical to do it before the home opener for the Seahawks, which we'll talk about in a bit here, but not before we get to your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
Well, I was initially going to do Mariners hot takes this week. I was so prepared about how the Mariners needed to call up Jared Kelenic. And then, you know what happened? There were false reports. Then there were real reports. You said cancel the hot takes. You don't think I could pivot on this, though? You said cancel the hot takes about Jared Kelenic. I said, do you really think I'm going to cheer for what basically amounts to service time manipulation? To exploitation of labor? Hell fucking yes, I am.
Wow, that's a pivot.
Because there is a thin line between baseball being completely unwatchable and right now, despite the best Sam Haggerty efforts, the Mariners are under that Mendoza line. I don't know if you've been watching lately, but it is not fun.
I'm not.
This is the most exciting debut in Seattle since Peltoncast episode one. Maybe since Katie made her first appearance. Since Treat Cookies opened a brick and mortar. I will be watching this more intently than I've been watching even my own children play. This is the new coach's corner. These are my children. Because if Kelenic is successful, I may just name my Knicks 10 to 15 children, Jared.
Wow. Well done. Well done. Yes. Yes, Jared Kelenic, he needed more time to develop at the AAA level, hadn't had enough at-bats in the minor leagues. So those six games he played for Tacoma, where he went 10 of 27 with two home runs in his debut and slashed 370, 414, 630, evidence that he finally had gotten sufficient experience.
Yeah, he just needed that experience.
But it's not just Kelenic who's coming up to start the series on Thursday night at T-Mobile Park. It's also Logan Gilbert. The Mariners 2018 first round pick number 14 overall out of Stetson University. Stetson, it's not just a hat, was rated the number 28 overall prospect by MLB.com entering the season, the list on which Kelenic was number four. And Gilbert allowed 4 hits and 5 runs in 5 innings in his only start at the AAA level last week. Now the 24-year-old will be making his major league debut on Thursday night alongside Kelnick. So the future is here.
Yeah, this is like Ken Griffey Jr. and Sr. back-to-back. I mean, this is a big deal. This is the most exciting. I don't think we can count Ichiro in the same class because Ichiro was such an established player by the time he debuted. Agreed. For the Mariners. It's since Felix at the very least, though.
Oh, yeah. I think I agree with Felix. I mean, Felix also came after Ichiro, so there's also that.
But if you look at exciting Mariners debuts, it's...
Oh, if we're like ranking them?
Griffey, A-Rod, Felix, Kelenic.
Okay.
I probably in that order, too. I guess I don't know where Kelenic would rank vis-a-vis. I think A-Rod and Griffey were probably more exciting. They were both number one picks in the draft.
Right.
Had more hype. Ken Griffey Jr. had the pedigree. And Alex Rodriguez had the youth, and I think everybody just knew he'd be an amazing player. The difference, though, and I feel like maybe this is a change in the way that baseball is played now. Maybe it's just a change in how shitty the Mariners are now. My expectation is that he's probably the best hitter on the team the second he walks into the dugout.
I mean, yes, it's a relatively low bar to clear at this point with the Mariners lineup, but there's a decent chance of it based on what we saw from him in spring training and how effective he was there.
Like A-Rod was 95.
He was not good in 94. He was promoted too early in 94 in hindsight. Like, he didn't embarrass himself in any sense, but he held his own. But he wasn't ready to start in the major leagues in 1994. And that was clear because he didn't play in the major leagues most of 95.
So his monster season came in 96.
Correct.
Yeah.
95, he like came up at the end of the season, you know, when the rosters expanded. He might have spent some more time in the majors than that, but he wasn't the starting shortstop. Luis Soho was. So
we were so freaking distracted by having all these superstar players on the team that we didn't even care that much about A-Rod. Like, there was a time where the Mariners had players who were so good that we didn't really think all that much about maybe the greatest baseball. I don't know. One of the 10 greatest baseball players in history or whatever, who was in the minor leagues at the time. And this wasn't something that consumed us because they had goddamn Ken Griffey Jr. and Randy Johnson and Edgar Martinez and Jay Buhner on the team all at once.
This is all accurate.
It's wild to think about.
It was a very different time. So we will continue the Kelnick watch once he's in the major leagues.
It's
and look forward to
all because of the kingdom. I'm telling
takes.
You.
Oh, you know? Oh, you always bring it back to the kingdom.
Has the team been? Has the team been good since
116 games? Yes, tied for the most in Major League history.
I do remember that.
Even you paid attention to that.
No, I didn't. I paid no attention. I've watched probably more Mariners games this season than I did in that season.
But you couldn't help but be aware of what they were doing in 2001.
And angry about it.
Oh no!
Come on.
Not sure if he was involved. Was he on the team? I assume he was. Definitely was in 2000. Let's talk about the Sounders, who are off to the best start in franchise, or have equaled the best start through five matches in franchise history. On Sunday, a thrilling 2-1 win over the rival Portland Timbers in Portland in front of fans for the first time in a Cascadia Club clash since 2019. A wild stretch in the middle of the second half saw the Sounders concede a penalty. Stephen Fry saved Diego Valeri's first attempt, only for a retake to be ordered by VAR because knew who was in the box early. On that retake, Valeri's shot went directly off the post back to him, which is not allowed. So Portland did not score. Shortly thereafter, Sounders drew a penalty, and Raul Ruidíaz coolly finished to give them the lead. They added an insurance goal later on a Freddie Montero header, which proved useful after the Timbers scored in stoppage time, but the Sounders still held on for the road derby win. Wednesday night, it was a 1-0 win at the San Jose Earthquakes. The only goal coming on a golazo from Christian Roldan just outside the top of the 18, off the crossbar and hard into the back of the net. But the big story of this match came in stoppage time of the second half, as Stephen Fry had to be helped off the pitch, unable to put weight on his left foot after being down.
How did I miss this?
An extended period. Yeah, you missed a lot happen. So the Sounders had already exhausted all their possible substitution periods. So they played with 10 the rest of the match, and Alex rolled on, put on the gloves, put on the jersey, and moved to keeper, immediately knocked away a ball on a set piece, and came up with 3 total saves in all in stoppage time to preserve the shutout and the win. An incredible performance by Alex Roldan.
Break up the Roldan brothers. This performance was so monster that you probably, as the listener, would have voted the famous Cousin Katie as MVP.
Oh, no. Not since Justin and Aaron Holiday with the Pacers have we seen two brothers doing so much for the same professional team. But seriously, though, the only goal and 3 saves as a defender in the same match.
Wow.
Big game for the Roldans.
Has Alex Roldan played
keeper?
Keeper?
No, it doesn't sound like it. I missed the first part of his post-match interview, but it didn't sound like he had a lot of experience. I mean, I think it's kind of just like, it's like the emergency pitcher situation in baseball where you're just kind of like, all right, who's going to do this? And he got the call.
Wow.
So the downside of this match, the injuries, Fry and then Jordy DeLem, who got the start at center back, had to be helped off in the early minutes of this match. And it looked like he was on crutches afterwards, an apparent knee injury. So hopefully good news on Stephen Fry and Jordy DeLem, but did not look super encouraging on DeLem in particular. Sounders back in action on Sunday, hosting LAFC, another nationally televised match at 6:30 p.m. on FS1 that we can watch while eating our June baby. Second matchup with LAFC this season. A rough start has seen LAFC win just one of their first 4 matches, falling to 10th in the Western Conference. They lost the El Tráfico to the LA Galaxy 2-1 on Saturday. Diego Rossi returned in that match and scored his first goal of the season, but Carlos Vela remained sidelined by the right quadriceps injury that kept him out of the 1-1 draw between these teams on April 24th. Also in Sounders news, they added another homegrown player Wednesday in 16-year-old midfielder Reed Baker Whiting.
There we go.
Played the full 90.
Don't tell me what year he was born. September 11th definitely had not happened.
Oh, not even close.
By like a lot of years.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
It is like he was born the year the Sonics went to the playoffs for the last time.
Wow. They were still a team? I mean, you know.
Yeah, okay.
He was
not after the vote.
The Office US had premiered, though.
Correct.
Oh, God.
No, I don't know. Maybe would that premiere summer of 2005 or 2004? I can't remember off the top of my head.
I don't want to think about it.
Baker Whiting went the full 90 for Tacoma Defiance in their opener last week, made 7 Defiant appearances for the Defiance last season while he also practiced with the Sounders. So they have a good sense of what they're getting with him. Another midfielder for that young group of homegrown players. Ethan Dovalier got the start on Wednesday night, so that was cool to see. It is to Danny Leyva. OL Reign news. They'll start the NWSL season, the regular season, after playing the Challenge Cup on Saturday, hosting the North Carolina Courage at 7 p.m. on Twitch. It's the first meeting between these two teams since the Reign lost to the Courage in the 2019 NWSL semifinals. Like the Reign, the Courage finished 2nd in their division in the NWSL Challenge Cup with an identical 7 points in the East, but their +1 goal differential was slightly better than the Reign, which was even. But bigger news, Stars on the way to Tacoma. OL forward Eugène Le Sommer, the all-time leading goal scorer for both the club and the French national team, is set to join OL Reign on loan after the June 15th end of the international opening of the international transfer window and remain with the team through the duration of the NWSL season. So a big-time scorer. And then Equalizer Soccer also reported that Rose Lavelle is set to join OL Reign this summer after last year's deal with Washington Spirit to acquire the NWSL rights to the U.S. Women's National Team standout, who is playing in England this season for Manchester City.
Huge!
So
they're going to be monster players in Miami.
Look, it's going to be exciting for the time being. Let's just enjoy it for now. them alongside Megan Rapinoe. Good stuff. Also opening the season.
The whole setup of soccer is ridiculous, right?
What?
There's owned by a French team. Just send players from France to fucking Tacoma, Washington.
Yeah. I mean, then they're excited to come to Tacoma, Washington. They want to play in the U.S. So it works out well for everyone.
Fair enough.
Also opening their season on Saturday in Everett, Washington, at the other end of Puget Sound, it's the Seattle Storm. The defending champs will play in Puget Sound for the first time since September 2019, hosting the Las Vegas Aces in a two-game home set Saturday at noon on ABC and then Tuesday night on ESPN. That serves as a rematch of the 2020 WNBA Finals played in the Wubble last year in Bradenton, Florida. Storm will be without Epiphany Prince and Mercedes Russell in these games, or at least the first game, as they won't clear quarantine in time after completing their Turkish finals on Tuesday. Aces will be
quarantined from, by the way. Is there a quarantine that I just do not know about?
From the WNBA. I mean, it's part of their...
It's a league quarantine. Yeah. Not a...
No, not a countrywide quarantine. No. You have to have 6 consecutive days of negative COVID-19 tests in order to be cleared to begin practicing or playing with the team.
Vaccinated or not?
I don't think that applies if you're vaccinated, but I don't think the indication is that they are. There were some reports that some players who were playing in Europe, not with the Storm, flew back to the U.S. to get vaccinated since it's more widespread here, I guess. The Aces will be without Angel McCautry, who suffered ACL and MCL tears in their preseason game. But they do welcome back Liz Cambage, who was medically excused from the bubble, to pair with reigning MVP Asia Wilson. And then also Kelsey Blum, UW product, back for her first game since suffering an Achilles rupture last spring. Before the McCautry injury, the Aces topped my colleague Michelle Vopel's power rankings for this season, with the Storm in second place there. Final roster for the Storm must be set by Thursday at 2 p.m. Pacific. Storm have 16 players in the roster, probably have 3 more cuts to make. The roster is typically 12, but what they can do is, because they have enough cap space, they can temporarily suspend the contract of one of Prince or Russell and use that to allow them to keep a 13th player on the roster. So, you know, the last two top draft picks, Kitty Alaksa and Kiana Williams, battling for spots, along with veteran Stephanie Talbot. We'll see what direction the Storm go. But, you know, it's going to be a very different look than the last time we saw the Storm winning the championship in the bubble. No Alicia Clark, who left for Washington in free agency and now sadly is out for the season with a Liz Frank injury. Natasha Howard gone after being sent in a sign and trade to the Liberty. Sammy Whitcomb, same thing, signed and traded to the Liberty. That's 3 of last year's, you know, basically top 7 players who the Storm are going to have to replace. And it's going to be interesting to see how they do that with some of the newcomers. Katie Lou Samuelson, Kiki Herbert-Harrigan, as younger players that they got in that trade with New York and a couple other teams involved with that, Minnesota and Dallas, from whom they got those players. And then veteran Candace Dupree, a multi-time All-Star, coming in to help replace Natasha Howard. But also, you know, I think we expect to see more from Ezzie Magbegor in her second season in the WNBA, someone whose future we're very excited about.
I considered my initial notes for the Mariners Hot Takes was that the debut of Kelenic was the most exciting debut since Ezzie Magbegor.
I take a little more hype for Kelenic.
That's outside hype. We're talking about right here, though.
Yes. I mean, Magbegor, you didn't even know was going to play in the first game. That was a little surprising. And then she came out and shut down Sabrina Ionescu on a switch. So the hype really started for Magbegor when she first took the court.
So they're going to be playing again at Angel the Winds Arena in Everett, Washington, correct?
Yes, not the casino, at the arena. All the games during the regular season will be there.
Are they going to have fans at these games?
They will have fans there, a limited number of fans. They're going to have vaccinated sections and some unvaccinated sections. As we're starting to see, the Sounders are going to open those up. I'm not sure if the Mariners are doing that for their homestand, but the Sounders for their next home game will have vaccinated-only sections as well.
Are you going to be one of the fans? Not fans, but are you going to be in attendance?
I will, yeah, I will not be in the arena bowl, but
I would never. No, thank you.
I mean,
absolutely. I swear to God. Will definitely not. Will not. No.
I didn't say that. I've sat in the stands with your family at a game back in the day, back when they were still playing in Key Arena.
I remember what it was like. I sat in the stands for a game. The tickets were, I don't know, $3 probably.
It's one banana, Michael. What could it cost?
There were more on a house in Brooklyn. $50. Nobody wants to go there.
I will be there.
I haven't been over the bridge in 10 years.
Apparently in the hockey press box is where I'm going to be.
In the hockey press
box. On Saturday, yeah. Tuesday, probably not, since the play-in will be starting.
You really didn't talk about what the experience was like being at the Blazers game also.
Yeah. I mean, it's very different. There was a dedicated media entrance. So, you know, I basically didn't run into anyone going in, and they've got the media up in behind the basket in the top of the lower bowl, which is where I often have been in the playoffs in the past, but a different place than I would normally sit now.
I'll have to say it was hard not sitting courtside though.
And I've not been sitting courtside at any point in Portland, except they played one preseason game over in the old arena in Memorial Coliseum 1 year. And I guess it was because I was doing stats for the Jazz radio broadcast, and I sat courtside for that one. That's the only time I've ever been courtside in Portland for a Blazers game, at least. NCAA tournament was a different. But so the fans were like very spread out through out the arena. Like they're, I think it's like 2,000, 10% capacity, but they're utilizing all of the Moda Center, which is giant, as you know, having been there and having done standing room only above the very last row. And so it was kind of weird. It's like pockets of crowd noise, but it feels kind of disconnected from each other. It's not like cohesive like it normally would be.
And so you never went to a game with no fans at all. So
correct.
You can't really compare, like, is it better to have no fans at all or to have a handful of fans?
I assume it's not better. I would be surprised if it were better.
Are they going to continue Portland, where, fingers crossed, looks like we're going to be maybe not part of the play-in tournament? Are they going to stick at 10% capacity for the playoffs, or...
You know, we'll see what the numbers look like in Oregon and how that evolves. Certainly some places, like I've seen the Sixers are going up to 10,000 for the playoffs. So that's going to be much closer to a real home court advantage. But, you know, not everyone is certainly going to be that aggressive. And it looked, I mentioned there were fans at the Sounders-Timbers match. As of earlier in the week, it looked like there weren't going to be fans. And then they moved back from, you know, their version of DEFCON, they moved back one level, and therefore they were able to have fans not only for the Timbers but also for the Blazers as well.
Cool.
So
was it weird for you though? I mean, I haven't been to a sporting, I think probably the first time I'll go to a sporting event is going to be going to a Mariners game in June, and I don't know what it's going to be like.
I mean, it was exceedingly weird. I mean, usually so much of the experience of going to a game is like a social thing of talking to people in the media room beforehand, or, you know, on press row being right next to someone and having a conversation with them throughout the game. And, you know, you're 6 feet away from people on press row, you're socially distanced there. I had one conversation with one friend of mine who is in that section who is fully vaccinated. And, you know, I sat like 3 feet away from them and chatted for a few minutes. And that was basically it as far as like talking to people. So
is it true that the CDC came out like this week and was like, LOL, it's actually way more than 6 feet. We were lying to you for a long time.
The 6 feet has never been a magic number. Like people want it to be. It's like, you know, I'm used to this where people want, like, how many games are stats reliable? Well, there's not one game. It's not like you play 19 games and the stats are meaningless and you play 20 and they're meaningful, but you have to draw a line somewhere. So I get it, CDC is what I'm saying.
Well, of course you do.
I don't know what that means. Yes, I'm, you know, I don't think the CDC has handled things perfectly, but I don't think they're the problem here. Anything else on the Storm looking ahead to their season? Are you going to declare Sue Bird washed up at any point here?
Oh, God. It's been years since I've done that.
Well, it's only been a year since you were proven wrong.
I will say, get Sue Bird a signature shoe, though. Are you fucking kidding me?
Fair point.
I swear to God, the shoes that people are just like, oh, I didn't get this Nike shoe. How many of these are they making?
It's a large number, surely.
It is literally the worst part of society is how many people... Look, I
can think of a lot worse parts of society.
I don't believe that human beings have agency or choice, but I also believe that no fucking person should make the choice to try to get some Nike shoes that you need to get there.
I would like to apologize on behalf of the Pelton cast to our sneakerhead, the listener. These views do not reflect those of the Pelton cast in general.
Or it's more just not having WNBA shoes.
Yes, it's long overdue.
I would actually assume that those the sneakerhead, the listener you're talking to, I don't know if there's a specific person. I'm guessing there isn't, but
I'm sure there is the listener who's a sneakerhead.
The person you're talking to would like there to be WNBA signature shoes.
Yeah,
the people who are fucking up are the institutions of power that you always are agreeing with, like the CDC.
Look, the CDC is just doing their best out there, okay? Both teams played hard. All right, let's talk about UW softball, which swept Utah by a combined 31-8 margin last weekend. Gabby Plin went 3-0 going the distance in a 6-inning shutout on Friday, where she struck out 10, won Saturday, and then pitched 6 innings Sunday, got the win, running her record this season to 27-1.
There we go. My God.
Kelly Lynch was named Pac-12 Freshman of the Week after going 5-for-12 with a homer in the series. Huskies closed the Pac-12 schedule this weekend by visiting Stanford, which comes in 6th out of the 9 Pac-12 teams at 8-10. UW has already clinched second place in the conference, but would need Arizona to sweep the 3 Pac-12 games they're playing this weekend against UCLA to overtake the Bruins for first. Let's wrap up as usual with the Seahawks, who saw their schedule released on Wednesday. The Seahawks will open their season at Indianapolis before hosting Tennessee in their home opener during week 2. Team plays twice each on Sunday Night Football and Monday Night Football, along with the typical Thursday Night Football game, for the maximum 5 scheduled national TV appearances. 3 of those come in consecutive weeks, starting on Thursday Night Football versus the rival LA Rams in week 5, Sunday Night Football at Pittsburgh the following Sunday, and concluding with Monday Night Football against the Saints. Seahawks will visit the Packers in week 10. That's, I assume, the Fox game of the week, but not a primetime game. In week 12, they play Monday Night Football at Washington Football Team, and then, which is just a lot of football, host 49ers on Sunday Night Football the following week, and then they close out the season at Arizona in week 18 on January 9th, as the schedule is extended a week this year with the move to a 17-game schedule.
Yeah.
Dynamite drop in money.
I mean, it definitely was a schedule.
The thing is, like Larry Bird's famous quote about the schedule was 41 home, 41 road looks good to me. That's not the case anymore in the NFL.
Well,
they
never played 41 home, 41 but away.
They used to generally play the same number home and away, and now that is not the case. But you knew that going in, that the Seahawks were going to play 9 road games.
I think the difference is I take this back. I was going to say when certain things happen in the NFL actually matters. But I think statistically, if we're having a conversation about it, it probably doesn't actually matter. So
it matters like a tiny bit, but not as much as people think it matters.
It feels like it matters when the bye week is. And most importantly, now that we're in this 18 game schedule, week 9 is right there in the middle. So right,
yes, I mean it was more in the middle in the 17 week schedule. I hate to break it to you, but yes, it's very much still in the middle.
I did 18 by half and ended up with 9, so it's right in the middle.
But they played 8 games beforehand and they'll play 9 games.
Don't explain this
afterwards.
To me. I did 18 and divided it by 2 and got 9, and that's when the bye week is. So it's exactly halfway. Thank you.
Oh, this is embarrassing. Hashtag Pelton Cast math.
Yeah, I really like, I mean, it. I have no schedule takes. Maybe it seems like the second half is a little bit easier than the first half, but we just don't know. You don't know how good these teams are actually going to be.
Yes, it's much harder to predict in the NFL, I would say. Yeah, I mean, you get the easier part of the NFC North in the second half of the season. It's interesting that the NFC West games are not as concentrated at the end of the season as they usually are, partially because of the fact that it's moved back. So, you know, the Seahawks play the Rams the week before Christmas, which is not like an unusual time to play an NFC West game. But then they just happen to have 2 NFC North games between that and the finale at Arizona. So,
yeah. 10 a.m. starts that we used to care about, but really don't anymore because the Seahawks are.
I mean, I still care about them from I want to watch Red Zone at 10 a.m. standpoint, and so only 2 of those is pretty solid.
Yeah,
one of which hopefully I will be on Central Time for, so won't even notice.
Which is that one? Oh, the Indianapolis.
The game
one.
In Indianapolis.
Yes.
So
you're planning to head to Ann Arbor for UW at Michigan, and I have to say, how about this? If I have a schedule take, playing Carson Wentz's Colts in Week 1 is kind of fun.
I mean, we're going to find out a lot about Carson Wentz and the Colts. It's going to be interesting. I don't know if we'll find out that much about the Seahawks because we won't know relative to just what is Carson Wentz and what if it's the Seahawks defense. But yeah.
Otherwise, I don't have a ton of takes. I mean, there's the chunk in the middle of the season where it's like at Pittsburgh being on a Sunday night. It's like I personally think Pittsburgh could just be god-awful this year. Also hosting New Orleans the next week, same type of situation. There's a lot of teams that have historically been good that I think possibly could be bad this year. Those 2 being pretty prominent among them.
I mean, also the disrespect to Jameis Winston has been noted.
yeah, I'm not sure if New Orleans is quite the same with Jameis as their quarterback. Maybe. Who knows?
I mean, I hate to break it to you. New Orleans won here 2 years ago. Drew Brees wasn't playing quarterback then either. Yeah, he was playing quarterback, just got traded for a sack of potatoes to Denver, if I recall correctly.
Right.
So, I mean, I agree, but I'm not penciling that one in as a W just yet.
I'm literally not penciling in a single game as a W.
That's
right?
That's fair.
At Houston, December 12th, that's still Deshaun. I don't know. Like, there's no game that you look at and you're like, that's an easy victory.
What is the most likely win on the Seahawks schedule?
Probably still hosting Jacksonville.
Yeah, I guess it's probably
maybe
that.
Detroit, January 2nd. But like, you're so far into the season that I feel like once you get to a certain part of the season, the chances of any game being randomly decided because of injuries are pretty high.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, you kind of like to see the second half of the season. Houston, who I'd probably not consider a playoff team. Chicago, Detroit, and Arizona. But also, it's just like, I don't know. It's a fucking schedule. Who cares?
A lot of people, as it turns out. Well,
it's an assortment of games.
I'm hoping you have some stronger takes about DK Metcalf's outcome in the 100-meter heats at the USA Track and Field Golden Games and Distance Open last Sunday. We finished 15th of 17 competitors with a time of 10.37 seconds. And he certainly acquitted himself quite well alongside professional runners hoping to make the Olympics.
I have no takes at all. DK Metcalf, I watched. DK Metcalf is pretty fast.
He started better than I expected. I figured that's where he was going to be really tripped up as compared to, you know, people that are doing this on a regular basis instead of training for football.
Yeah, I guess that was kind of interesting that the start, I mean, he was right in the mix in the start.
Right.
And then kind of lost it over time. So Maybe if there's anything that we've learned about track and field from DK Metcalf being in a race is that maintaining your speed is harder than starting.
Well, I mean, the thing is, you know, the reason supposedly they run the 40-yard dash in the NFL for times is someone decided, I forget apocryphally who it is, was like, that's the longest you'd run on almost any given play. Now, DK ran a hell of a lot longer than that when he chased down Buda Baker, which is what sort of inspired this whole thing.
40 yards is how long you'd run on any given play?
Like the most you'd run on any given play. Which I think generally is probably true. I mean, there's the occasional long run or long touchdown pass, but those are pretty rare, more that plays of more than 40 yards. But the other thing is, when you have those long plays, usually you slow down by the end. And sprinters, their whole thing is they kind of need to not slow down by the end of it. That's really important to sprinting.
I think that DK is really, really fast.
I mean, very, very fast. And he, you know what? He's exactly doing everything right to be an NFL wide receiver. Maybe not to be a sprinter in the Olympics, but to be an NFL wide receiver, don't change a thing, DK.
When his body is just not built like a sprinter also.
Right.
You know, the way that he's been training, he's been building up muscle. Like, muscle doesn't necessarily make you faster. I just think DK is such a unique body. And I think it was an amazing thing that DK did. And I really appreciate that he was willing to just go for it.
It was fun.
Try it out.
It was very fun.
Exactly. That's what literally all of what we're talking about is supposed to be fun. Eating chicken is supposed to be fun. Fucking playing sports is supposed to be fun. That's the most important thing. And I really
appreciate my signature shows are supposed to be fun.
That I appreciate that that's actually capitalism. But well, that I suppose leads back to capitalism. But I appreciate that DK Metcalf was just willing to try some shit out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And lose, right? Like, I don't know if he had to humble himself necessarily, but like, he went into a race and he finished last, you know?
In his heat, yes.
So I feel like, nobody looks at times, though. The most important thing is that you're running against people and those people finish the race before you.
But I don't know. Like, think about it if you're the professional sprinter and you finish behind DK Metcalf. Like, that can't feel great.
Well, also, DK Metcalf's a goddamn pro bowler.
Yeah. Here was his quote as far as takeaways. These are world-class athletes, he told Lewis Johnson on the broadcast on Peacock. They do this for a living. It's very different from football speed from what I just realized. So like I said, just excited to be out there.
Very recently just realized.
In say the last 10.37 seconds, give or take. So it was fun to watch. And definitely the first track and field race I've watched since last year's Olympics. The last Olympics.
I was going to say, I'm pretty sure that was canceled. I don't know.
I'm aware.
You watched it?
In my head, played it all out. U.S. won a
Bob
lot
Costas.
Of golds in the team sports.
Wow, when I play that, Italy wins.
Not even in the track and field events?
All of them. No, I don't know.
Well.
But yeah, I that was the only take that I have. Is it was a fun thing to watch a track and field event on a Saturday that I otherwise wouldn't have paid attention to.
Agreed.
So.
Well, on that takeless note.
That's why I deserve to be the MVP of the year. On that takeless note.
Just so sick of people campaigning for themselves. I've had enough of it.
I'm the MVP of every single season. Takeless and thankless.
I'm only going to agree with it if my spreadsheet of advanced stats says so. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.